Hello, listeners. Welcome to the Culture and Climate Nexus. This episode explores the contemporary Egyptian-Nubian experience with climate change and how it influenced their cultural life and social dynamics. Their story tells a tale of adaptation, resilience, and the intricate dance between human cultures and their environments. My name is Missimi Owolabi, and I'm this podcast's host. Imagine standing on the banks of the Nile River, where the water shimmers under the blazing sun and the land stretches far beyond the eyes. Here, you can feel the weight of history and life that's flowed for thousands of years. This is the home of the Egyptian Nubians. The Egyptian Nubians are renowned for their cultural heritage, social structures, and their deep ties to the Nile River. Unfortunately, in recent years, the effects of climate change has posed significant challenges to their livelihoods and traditions. Their experience contains adaptations and resilience as they strive to preserve their cultural identity and sustain their way of life. I'm thrilled to introduce a guest for this podcast, a historian who has done research in Africa, including Ethiopia, Southern Africa, Senegal, and Ghana. He participated in many local community projects, focusing on how these communities have adjusted to their natural environments and how they approach their challenges. Please welcome Professor James McCann. Hello, Professor McCann, and welcome as a guest on the Climate and Culture Nexus. I emailed Professor McCann after a history teacher recommended him to me and looked over his works, including The Green Land, Brown Land, Black Land, and Environmental History of Africa. During his research, he has physically seen how people have adapted to their surroundings and how migration and trade have shaped their communities. He also has seen how the varied landscapes result in diverse interpretations of the natural world and responses to climate change. So, this podcast will first focus on the Egyptian-Nubian's historic context and the change he has observed. We will then examine the importance of the Nile River, specifically its cultural importance, and we will dive into how colonialism and environmental changes affect the Nile and the overall availability of water in the region. We will then discuss how gender dynamics have been ultra-effective, as well as occupational dynamics. We will then look at the Egyptian-Nubian's identities and how it evolved due to climate change in terms of culture, occupation, and class. We will then discuss how Egyptian-Nubians perceived climate change and their local adaptation efforts. Professor McCann will first talk a little about himself.
I've been interested a long time in African studies. I'm a historian. I'm a historian of the way people live their lives over time. And the variety of places I've been to do work in Africa takes me to, at first, Ethiopia, or the various places in Ethiopia, which is so incredibly diverse, but also in Southern Africa, where I participated in projects in local communities. Why do they grow certain crops? How do they adjust to changes in their natural environment, including things like, as Europeans express an interest in climate? And then how does climate interact with the way people live their lives and approach the challenges they face? Of course, there are many challenges. I've also worked in West Africa, in Senegal and Ghana. Part of the book I had sent to you, that there's a chapter there on called Ghana. And Ghana is a very different setting for how people organize their economic and cultural lives. I'm also the co-convener of a conference in Finland on Africa. The panels on Africa, and arguing that the connection for environmental history and environmental issues is also connected very much to the humanities. How do people express their feelings about their world? That has to do with paintings and poetry and literature and language. All those things reflect the way people think about their lives, and the environment's part of that. And I always argue that it's those factors of humanities, how people express themselves, that really let us understand more fully what's likely to be the outcomes in terms of the way they confront their natural world, the environment, including climate.
As you can see, Professor McCann has a rich engagement with African studies. He explores the interplay between environmental factors, cultural dynamics, human experiences, and the diverse spirits in these regions. So, what differences have you observed, Professor McCann?
If it's one of the points that I would make to proceed is that the idea of Africa being one place Africa has many different environments, ecologies, and those are reflected in the genocide cultures of where do you find your, where people find themselves, how they, who they trade with, how they move, who is more in their new areas. And these are many, many different examples. Africa is not one physical place, but there's so many varieties of the way people interpret and live in their natural world. Now, how they adjust to climate change is part of that.
Thank you for pointing that out, Professor McCann. It's essential to be aware that Africa has 54 countries and multiple cultures and heritages within each one. A unique feature of Egypt that is very important to Egyptian Nubian is the Nile River. As I discussed in the introduction episode of this podcast, the Carnegie Museum of Natural History article outlines how the Nile is culturally significant because it provides water and silt, land for agriculture, means of transportation, and religious significance.
One of my major focus in my research, my current project, is about the Nile. And of course, the Nile begins in Ethiopia. 84% of the water that reaches Cairo comes out of Ethiopia. It doesn't come out of East Africa. Many people misunderstand that. In fact, let me show you.
How has it shaped the lives of the Egyptian Nubians or Ethiopians, since that is what you focus on?
Well, I think the idea culturally, the name for the Blue Nile, we have two Nile, the Blue Nile and the White Nile. The Blue Nile is the one that provides most of the water, and it comes during the rainy season in Ethiopia, and then it declines a little bit, but still is the major source of water that reaches. And it carries the soil with it, and so the name for the Blue Nile, the Ethiopia, is Abai. This is a relationship to really my father. And it is a way of people relating to those waters of the Nile are symbolically very important for ritual religious activities. So, for example, the very place where the Nile comes out of the ground, it stood there on the very spring, and that's where there were ritual sacrifices of animals to create the propitious relationship with the deity. Predominantly Christian area, and so they are recognizing the importance of water as something that gives holiness, that gives humanity to humans who derive their livelihood from it. And so that my work has been in that physical, the actual place where the Nile emerges from the ground. Okay. Symbolically, the travelers who have come over the many, many centuries to that place, they include Portuguese, Scots, English, of course, many different Ethiopian peoples who know that place. They recognize that place is symbolic. The water, of course, is a small amount of the stream. It's symbolic of what makes them human, what makes them have a relationship to their deity. And that is a major part of the meaning of the water, not just the physical water, but the symbolic meaning of the water is important. And as you move down the Nile from the inter-Sudan, the same kind of effects of people recognize this is the heartbeat of their economic and social culture. And going into Egypt, even though religions change, the people change, and Nubians are different than the people of Cairo, Nubians are different than most of the people of Sudan who live along the banks of the Nile. Nonetheless, they all have some kind of meaning of that water in their life, of religion, of poetry, and of representation of what does water mean, the meanings of the water.
You're highlighting the deep cultural and symbolic significance of the Nile. More specifically, the Blue Nile branch, which shows how important water is to people in Ethiopia and the Egyptian Nubians. It really is not just about the physical water. It's culturally significant because of how it connects to history, tradition, and spirituality. It shapes the way of life for many people and even connects various cultures along its banks. What other impacts and effects has climate change had on the Egyptian Nubians?
Well, it's the connection, the water flowing from East Africa, both from the White Nile and the Blue Nile, coming into what then is Nubia. death has always been connected by, for example, the Aksumite Empire in Ethiopia controlled at one point that part of southern Egypt, in the Nubian area. Just as the Egyptian civilization, of course, was a major, major part of the world culture. And they were always deriving, they understood that the Nile was the source of their livelihoods. Their whole being came from the Nile. Because beyond the banks of the Nile, Egypt and northern Sudan are barren. Their life comes from the water.
What particularly strikes me is how these relate heavily to the global challenges today, such as climate change. Unfortunately, these events make water more scarce for some groups due to the drought. These societies allow us to reflect on an understanding of water resource management.
If we take southern Egypt, it's very much organized around the presence of water that's then managed by local populations for how do you cultivate crops, which crops do you cultivate, how do you manage to relate your political system to the fact that the Nile is something that changes over time, over the long term, and also changes year to year. Seasonality, if you're able to look at that section I passed on to you, that chapter, it's about seasons, and it's about changes over time in the amount of water available, the moisture available through rainfall or through the movement of the river. Basically, it doesn't rain in Cairo. Cairo depends primarily on the movement of the water from the Ethiopian islands and from East Africa into Egypt and eventually into the Mediterranean, although the water now in these days does not really ever reach the Mediterranean. So the water is a critical issue for Egypt. Egypt's having tough times now. The effects of inflation and of how do you negotiate to make sure that your economy has access to the water. That's the foundation of the Egyptian economy.
I want to note that climate change has also had other cultural effects on the Egyptian Nubians. Some of these include displacement of the Egyptian Nubians due to rising sea levels or changes in rainfall patterns due to climate change, highlighted by Ammonia Seed. In the Frontline article, The Angels of the Nile Are Dying, the author discusses how there is displacement due to climate change. The article highlights how hardships exacerbated by issues such as colonialism and poverty have made life much more difficult for the Egyptian Nubians. These factors include agriculture, water scarcity, and extreme weather. Speaking of colonialism, how does that affect the Egyptian Nubians and exacerbate the climate crisis there?
Well, Europeans were always concerned about the Nile as a place that, because Egypt was geographically really important, for a long, long period of time. When Napoleon went there, the British eventually were competing with the French. And so there were different kind of accommodations that Egypt made to become, in 1920, a condominium that they jointly ruled with the local Egyptian government. And the British were the ones on top of that situation because the British cared very much about how do you keep access to the water, because that was the heartbeat of that such a geographically important area, which we know it's Egypt. So colonialism, Egypt has a different kind of colonial history than other parts of Africa. Sudan was also part of, controlled by Egypt. Egypt had extended itself historically into Sudan to control the water and also to control population. But the relationships between Egypt, especially southern Egypt, but also in the Sudan, had to do with access to the water, but also the importation of people in form of people carried as slaves out of Sudan into Egypt and also into the Mediterranean world. And that was a part of that colonial heritage of Egypt. But it's complicating compared to the rest of Africa, where there's not direct control, but the French, or the Italians, or the British. Egypt had a condominium relationship where local leadership derives from the Mediterranean world. Muhammad Ali, not the boxer, but for Muhammad Ali, the ruler, he was a Mamluk. A Mamluk is someone who was had descended from slaves at the court in Egypt, and he's the one who expanded Egyptian influence over Nubia and into East Africa when Egypt was fundamentally an important player in that world. Was it also involved in expanding itself into both the coastline of Ethiopia, the Red Sea, and into Sudan. So it's a complicated colonial situation, in which eventually the British dominated by the time of the 20th century, the British were the chief force there, and then Egyptian nationalism came to play as they fought against the British. So by the time Nasser came into power in 1956 in Egypt, it's a complicated situation. But Egypt was part and parcel of that, both participating in and being subjected to effects of colonization.
Yeah, it is fascinating how colonial powers such as the French and the British brought over Egypt's resources, specifically access to the Nile. This demonstrates how colonialism often involved exploiting natural resources like water to serve their own interests. In an interview I conducted with Andrew Smith, a researcher focusing on Native American populations in Arizona and Mexico, it was revealed that indigenous communities perceived climate change as a manifestation of colonization. Smith's research further suggests that colonization exacerbates the impact of climate change on these communities. By disrupting their traditional ways of life, colonization left indigenous communities vulnerable to climate change and environmental degradation. This concept could also shed light on the impact of colonization and climate change on marginalized populations worldwide. The Nubian people have also faced historical displacement and exploitation. Therefore, there may be some understanding of historical justice and a struggle for cultural resilience there. While indigenous communities view climate change very negatively as an ongoing colonization, it is also important to illustrate these interconnected dynamics. An example of this is the Aswan Dams. For those unfamiliar with these two dams, the Low Dam, the first one, was created during the British colonial era in the Egyptian city of Aswan. The second took shape as the High Dam in the 1960s. These dams generated electricity for hydropower, flood control and irrigation, and water supply management. However, according to an article, How Egypt's Aswan Dam Washed Away Nubian Heritage, one of the most significant consequences of the High Dam specifically was the displacement of Egyptian Nubians peoples who inhabited the Nile Valley. The construction of dams like the Aswan High Dam, intended to initially address water management challenges in a region where water fluctuates significantly. However, climate change intensifies these challenges, causing these dams' disruptions to worsen. Can you, Professor McCann, explain more about how these events surrounding the Aswan Dam influence Egyptian Nubians' vulnerability to climate change?
Well, climate change is, as the map I first sent you, can you get that?
Yes.
If you look at that map, that's a map that predicts rainfall availability, water availability for Africa as we look into the future. And the two places you see that have the brown markings on them, one is the Zambezi, and the other one is this is where the water comes from, because it gets to Egypt. And so the prediction from those UN projections is that water is going to be a very, very key declining resource. So the expectations of the Ethiopians building their own dam, the Egyptians are not happy about. But it's going to be, the water is going to be in very short, very scarce supply. That's a big deal. Water is a fundamental issue for all of these questions about political power, about who has access to water to grow their crops, to be able to move, to trade. All of these things are under significant threat by climate change. And the best predictions we have is that it's going to be even more of a scarce resource.
It's crucial to spotlight the critical intersection between climate change and political dynamics. The prediction of declining water availability in regions like Ethiopia and Egypt increases geopolitical tensions over water resources. Competition for water supplies sometimes causes alliances or conflicts to secure access to water for agriculture and industry, exacerbating existing power imbalances and instability in the region. These can alter how people interact with their environment and even see themselves. Can you speak, please, on how climate change alters how Egyptian Nubians view their cultural identities?
That one's hard for me because I've not worked in Nubia directly. I've worked in Sudan. But Sudan is a complex of many different cultures and geographies. But I think it's a fair question to ask. If we were designing a search for you to do, would be to go to Nubia and ask that very, very question. It's the key question: how are they relating the changing conditions of the water availability? Because they depend upon the water. But once you leave the immediate area and you fly over, many, many times I've flown over the Nile, going over Egypt and into Ethiopia, you see the river is a green stripe as you look down from the windows of the plane flying over. And outside of that immediate area of the Nile, it's brown. The Nile itself is what gives life. And beyond that, you have to move the water or find access to some way of having a livelihood beyond the river itself. And so, of course, this affects the Nubians. This affects everyone who lives on the Nile. The key source of life, it is declining. The water, as I said, no longer flows into the Mediterranean from Egypt. It's all taken up by Egypt and Sudan. And Ethiopia now is going, their new dam is to store that water. They promised they've all used it for agriculture. But we'll see that how much more water will there be will be able to be released from that dam in Ethiopia. So it's the big political issue of the day. And people are being engaged in how do we negotiate this politically so that people have access to that water. But Ethiopia controls it. The water comes off the Ethiopian islands.
This is very intriguing. The Nile has long been a central part of the Egyptian Nubians' lives and culture. But climate change is clearly disrupting that. For example, the way the Nile changes colors and a dwindling water flow demonstrates these observations. So, in a sense, the Egyptian Nubians' cultural identities are being challenged, which forces a renegotiation of their relationship with the Long River. Moreover, other African groups are facing something similar, just as Ethiopia, which Professor McCann has done deep research on, asserts control over the water's flow in their highlands, altering the dynamics of the Nile. The Egyptian Nubians also deal with concerns about the river. The Egyptian Nubians see themselves at the forefront of discussions preserving their cultural heritage in the face of climate change. These cultural changes also expand into social dynamics like gender and occupation. Can you, Professor McCann, speak to how gender dynamics have been affected by climate change and how it has affected Egyptian Nubians' view on their cultural identities?
Well, that is the key question. If you could go to any of these places on the Nile, ask those questions. Those are some of the questions I ask when I'm in Ethiopia. Again, as the place where the Nile comes out of the ground. Of course, the water comes from many different places to follow me to Egypt. But that one place symbolically is about, you can ask questions about gender. How do women relate to water in that setting compared to men? What way? It's different for each of the societies. As you move down the Nile from the highlands into Sudan and into Egypt, each of those societies answer those questions in different ways. But those are research questions to be explored. Gender is an important issue. Social class, political relations, who really controls the symbolic as well as the physical meaning of the Nile. If you're contrasting it that with San, there are no river systems. Water comes from small sources of water for the San, who are hunting and gathering people, and who have existed in the presence of a major economic power of South Africa, which its economy is based on mining and the connected into the world economy. So the San are beneath those systems of control. So their life is not about based on a river. Water, of course, you have the water, but it's hunting and gathering as an economic livelihood rather than living next to a river where you can, in fact, draw the water for agriculture and transport it. So it's a very, very interesting situation. The Nile versus a hunting and gathering society. as to contrast ethnic levels of score.
Yes, I agree. Gender dynamics influence how women and men relate to water and other aspects of life, and it varies along the Nile. Not one size fits all. Intersects with many other factors. As mentioned in the introductory episode, the source national strategy from mainstreaming gender and climate change in Egypt implies gender dynamics can vary within a sinking country. Your perspective and the perspective of my source show how important it is to conduct research to understand the intersectionality of gender and climate change. This source, particularly national strategy for mainstreaming gender and climate change in Egypt, discusses how gender inequality and climate change are extremely linked. For example, it discusses how women often bear the brunt of climate change due to gender disparities in access to resources, education, finances, and decision-making powers. Although they're trying to increase the number of women in office, these issues worsen their vulnerability to climate changes. A quote that stood out to me is how they said, "Climate change is not gender neutral." This suggests that climate change responses that must be kept in mind that the specific needs of different people and ignoring these gender dynamics can worsen inequality and undermine the effectiveness of interventions. Another thing that sticks out to me is how occupational dynamics have also been affected for the Egyptian Nubians due to climate change. For example, changes in precipitation patterns affect crop yields and availability of water for irrigation, forcing Egyptian Nubians to change their practices. Some individuals seek alternative livelihoods, such as migrating to urban areas to find employment that is less dependent on natural resources. What are your thoughts, Professor McCann?
Well, for modern Egypt, Egypt was based upon the availability of water for agriculture on the Nile itself. And in a very clever way of moving the water from the river to the fields by the technology developed. Egypt had this for centuries on centuries. Dynastic Egypt understood how to move the water from the river to their fields, and therefore able to feed a larger population.
It's clear how much Egypt's occupational dynamics have relied on the Nile throughout centuries. However, recent technological advancements have significantly changed how Egyptians interact with their environment. In response to climate change, threats to Egyptian culture, and heightened risks, there's a growing emphasis on sustainable water management practices, including investment in irrigation systems. Adapting to climate change challenges, the Egyptians are turning to more innovative agricultural technologies. These methods, like irrigation systems, grow crops that can better withstand climate change. Some Nubians are also exploring alternative methods beyond agricultural life, such as ecotourism initiatives. Using both types of knowledge, traditional and modern, Egyptian Nubians are attempting to preserve their cultural heritage while adapting to climate change. Can you speak further on how Egyptian Nubians are fighting back against climate change and resisting further?
Well, it's climate change is something that's a much bigger process, determined by global issues. But one of the key factors is how do you store water? How do you use and perceive water? Both for ritual purposes and for religion, how do you baptize people? How do you cure disease by use of water? So it had medicinal purposes, it has livelihood purposes in terms of food. But what people are looking with is the fact that they have to store the water, even if that's done by a reservoir for a dam. But if you build a dam, what happens to the place where you're building the dam, the people's access to water? I visited a site near where the very, very near where the Nile comes out of the ground. And we were doing work on malaria. And so they let us come on to a place where they had built a dam. Ethiopian governments had built a dam with a lot of international contributions to build up this dam project to store the water. And the guard on that land, he said, "You can't come in here." We said, "No, wait, we have permission. The manager of your project just gave us permission." And he had his rifle there, and he said, no, you can't come in here. And said, well, please, we need to go, we want to come in here to see how this is affecting where mosquitoes will live and where you have a problem with malaria, et cetera. So finally he let us in, and then we began talking to him. And he said, you know, he said, I'm a guard here. This used to be my land. And so he had to take a salary as a guard, a very low paying salary, to be a guard on this dam project. Because his land was now covered with water. Because they had stored the water on his land, he lost his land. And so he became our friend, but his reason he was protecting it is because that was his job as a guard. But he had lost his land as a farmer because of the way the water was controlled and stored behind the dam. These are all very helpful questions for the people who live there. And did the government listen to him? No. The government wants to produce electricity. They want to produce agriculture by controlling the water. Who gets access to that water? Depends on where you fit relative to the government. So these are tough local issues.
I like that you highlight the challenges they face in combating climate change and resisting further consequences. The focus is on water management and how it impacts local communities, like the loss of land, as well as political dynamics in managing water resources. The story of the dam illustrates how projects can lead to displacement. His continued work at the dam site shows resistance or adaptation. Despite the loss, he maintains his connection to his land and community. Who do you typically talk to when you ask best questions when you visit Africa? Academics or local people?
For all of the above, but especially local people. I do interviews with people. I did a project for Oxfam where it took me 6 hours by a mule to get to the place, which was affected by drought and by the famine. And I spent 2 months there interviewing farmers. Farmers were both my neighbors there. I was the only outsider of there. I got malaria, by the way. But interviewing people and saying, okay, how do you get access to the materials you use for agriculture? And so these people became both people I was interviewing and my friends. That kind of interaction, and of course I talk to academics too. My friends in the Addis Ababa, the capital, I interact with them all the time, even by email now. The farmers who were there, we were living together. I was the only outsider there. And we had jokes, and they would come and play music in the evening. I have a chief here of our friend Bedrou who would come, and I'd fall asleep to him playing the instrument. We're talking about the difficulties of life in this area. And these people, you know, were and became my friends. So those interactions, you were day-to-day, not just the actual questions you're asking, by observing them. By observing the way they cultivate their land, what they eat, what they prepare, and the relationship between men and women, old and young. Those are things you can only observe by being there and living within with people. And it's a wonderful thing to do, and you hope that it helps them as well.
Thank you so much for sharing your insights with me, Professor McCann. Before we end today's episode, please share any recommendations on books or resources to read to learn more about this topic. Okay.
So again, those are very, I shouldn't say this, but very influential books in terms of Africa's environment. That's why I'm leading this standard. Since Hell's in Finland above the Arctic Circle, but there are 1,200 people from around the world who are coming to this meeting. But some of the other, I'm looking at my bookshelves here. And so classic works of another pair of works by so many of them around direct issues about water and about climate, but also most especially about agriculture and what people do to make their livelihood work.
Thank you again for agreeing to have me interview you, Professor McCann. You have very good insights on this topic and shared so many exciting ideas.